You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Auto D Show here on Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Networks, broadcasting from high above Camelback Road in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Daniolo, and tonight my guest is an award-winning journalist and podcast producer. He's a sought-after public speaker and DJ. And if that isn't enough to get you interested in this guy, he's also a living kidney donor and a proud New Yorker. So as the founding director of the Center for Hip-Hop Advocacy, much of his time is spent sharing and spreading the impact hip-hop music has and can have on our lives in many facets. So there's a ton of things we're going to get to talk about, and we'll get to it right after this first cut from the Fervor Records catalog called Conquer by Moonwalker here in the Auto D Show. Check it out.
Listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
And that was Conquer by Moonwalker here on the Auto D Show, which is brought to you in part by my good friends at Fervor Records, and also by the Roku TV channel called The Recording Artist, which features indie bands in the recording studio making records with me running the show. So be sure to download the channel for free and check it out. And if you want to watch us make the show live, then subscribe there on Roku or at therecordingartist.com. It's kind of cool. And now, it's not often I get to interview a podcaster on my podcast, but here it goes. Mr. Manny Faces, welcome to the show, Manny. How are you doing?
Otto D, how you doing, sir? I'm doing well.
I'm doing great. First thing I have to ask you, well, I can never pull that off. There's a million things I want to ask you first, but the name Manny Faces, it sounds like many faces, which certainly fits what you do. You've got a ton going on.
It's not my government name. My government name, just between us, is Bobby Elbows. Okay. No, I'm just kidding. it is a little play on words, and it does have a little bit of a connection, you know, connotation to, you know, having different, I don't know, moods or different, wearing different hats, you know, wearing different faces.
Uh-huh.
So,
I love
a little
it.
Bit of wordplay there.
Yeah, I love it. You know, in your bio, we talks about you as a journalist, a podcast producer, an entrepreneur. We're going to obviously talk about the nonprofit Hip Hop Advocacy Center, all of your podcasts and newsletters. You got so much going on. So I was wondering, you know, you're a speaker, and I've watched you speak on video, and you're a DJ. So I was wondering, where did music come into you? I mean, you grew up in New York, right, for a while at least?
Yeah, most of my life was in New York on Long Island, so right outside of the city. So we're, you know, sixth borough, as it were. And I'm roughly about the age, you know, hip hop is now turning 50, so I'm about the same age. So we kind of grew up parallel to the culture and the genre. DJing was actually pretty much the first, my first connection to music, other than being a listener and a fan or what have you. But I did start getting into DJing pretty early. I was a teenager, around 14, 15. And, this is the time that hip hop was starting to be important or more visible. And, my dad was a big music fan and connoisseur, I guess. He was a jazz and blues guy. So listening to him listen to music and play music and mess around with his turntable, which he did not like very much as I was trying to the early days of trying to learn how to scratch.
Especially on his turntable.
My early days, yeah.
You know, he's a jazz musician, so he thinks of things differently, and his turntable was probably very important to him.
Oh, please. It was like a Lafayette diamond tip needle, you know, belt turntable, which just wasn't built for, you know, that sort of thing in the first place. But
I know. Just seeing you scratching on that, I think he'd have a heart attack.
He did. We quickly learned that's not the thing to do. But, you know, that was it. That was sort of my first connection to making music or being more, intimately involved in music, aside, again, from just listening to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with hip-hop culture and, you know, we're young, we're in high school, we're banging on the table and making beats, you know, with our, you know, little drum patterns with our fists and we're DJing. I'm starting to get into some music production, drum machines, and trying to do sort of the electronic assisted creation of hip-hop music in my teenage years. Right. That's kind of how I got into it.
Well, that's cool. I want to ask you a question because I was in the studio making records starting in about the mid-80s, and the first time a producer came to me with a record. It was actually CeCe Peniston's debut album, which is called Finally.
Oh.
I did that record.
Yeah.
But when we started that record, one of the producers, Felipe Delgado, was like, hey, you know, roll up a track. I'm gonna play the beat off of this record. And I'm like, play the beat off of a record? What? I'd never heard of that. I'm used to bands, you know? And so he had this beat record, but he only played, it's like four bars, and it would change. So we stopped. And this is way before you could sync anything. So then it's like, okay, well, roll back the tape machine. I'll roll back the record, hit play, and four bars in, hit record again, and I'll fly the next four, you know, bars in. And we built all of the drum tracks that way with these short little loops, punching them in on tape in real time. And I thought, wow. So I wonder, did you get into the studio when you were first spinning like that?
So no, but you're touching on something that all, you know, hip hop early aficionados would recognize when I say this. You might have heard the term. We would make pause tapes.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd make pause tapes off of the radio, you know, in the 80s in this time. And I'm in New York City, so I'm in the Mecca of hip hop. But even then, you could only get rap music on the radio Friday and Saturday nights from like 10 p.m. to about, 2 a.m., right? Mm-hmm. Kiss FM, WBLS, the two black music stations in New York. So you had to make your tapes from those shows and then play them back during the week. But you wouldn't want the commercials. You wouldn't want the talking in between. So we would pause the cassette recorder to try to make our own mixtapes, essentially.
Oh, that's cool.
And that sort of sits at the heart of what you're talking about, you know, putting it together, it's maybe splicing tape even, right, early in the studio, is at the heart of hip-hop music sort of. There's a famous quote by Grandmaster Caz, one of the early pioneers, and he made this quote in The Art of Rap. It's a documentary, which is a really good documentary that was put together by Ice-T. And in it he says, you know, hip-hop didn't invent anything, but hip-hop reinvented everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of music making and that way of remixing and taking something and splicing it together and taking from different genres and piecing it all together, you know, that kind of sits at the heart of the ingenuity that I always felt was, again, at the heart of hip-hop. Yeah.
In fact, you touch on remix. I got to tell you, that word changed with hip hop, because when I used to be told, hey, we're going to do a remix, that meant they didn't like something about the mix. You pulled the reel back up, you did it again, and you changed the volume of something, you know. And the first remix I did was for a producer who came with a project for Atlantic Records, and the only thing on the reel of tape was the vocal. And I'm like, what do you mean? There's nothing here to mix. And he goes, I think we're supposed to make the music. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm supposed to mix it. No, he's supposed to make it. That's not remixing. That's remaking, man.
That's interesting that would have been such a foreign thing to come across your desk.
Oh, it totally was. As an
engineer. By the way, that finally was a huge record, man. It's a monumental record.
Oh, it was. In fact, you know, CeCe's still to this day, she's a dear friend. And it's so cool to see somebody start out in the beginning, you know, kind of struggling with nothing, hit it like that, and then they can. Yeah. She's performing the rest of her life. She's performing on that and makes a living. Yeah. That's just fantastic. Yeah. I love that story. You know, that was a great record. It was a lot of fun doing that record. That was my first gold record.
I still play that record to this day.
Oh, cool, man. That's really, really cool. Yep, I got a co-writing credit on one of the tunes, "Inside That I Cried," which was a ballad on the record. But that was a fun record. We built a lot of great relationships that remained for years through that whole crew. But so that was foreign to me. In fact, when we mixed the first song for the record, I did a mix on the console, you know, and about 30 minutes just to show everybody in the room how good I was, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the producer goes, "Okay, you ready to mix?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And I scoot over, and he goes, "Okay." And he pulls all the faders down, and he starts over. And I'm like, "Oh, I guess I don't get how this is supposed to be," you know, because styles are so different. And I think for engineers, you come from, you're working on rock records, and you're not listening to anything else for 2 or 3 years, and then all of a sudden you're working on something else, and you kind of get tuned into that. And I was apparently way off base when we started that record. It was kind of funny for me. But let's get back to you. I'm sorry, but
no, it's all good.
So you were spinning. When did you leave New York?
Oh, I didn't leave New York until, you know, just a few years ago. So, you know, most of my adult life, I grew up, I was on Long Island. And then just a few years ago, I moved to Newark, New Jersey. So I was still kind of in the New York tri-state. And then there's no after pandemic yet, but, you know, kind of about almost 2 years now, we moved to the Atlanta metropolitan area. We did that thing that New Yorkers do. We moved to Atlanta. So
cool.
So now I'm in the other mecca of hip hop music and culture, Atlanta.
How do you like Atlanta?
But throughout there, I'm okay with it. It reminds me, because we're a little bit outside of the city proper, so you know, we're about maybe 40 minutes away, so it's kind of suburban, and it kind of reminds me of where I came up. So it's a good vibe. I like being far enough from, you know, the big city to be able to dip in and out whenever I want and still kind of come home. And I don't like all the bugs. There's a lot of different bugs here. I'm not used to all these bugs. I have toads now in my backyard. Like, I didn't know about toads. Why are there toads in my backyard?
Like, what's that noise?
There's some adjustments to it. But other than that, it's really cool. Atlanta's a really, you know, vibrant city. A lot of art, a lot of music, obviously hip hop, you know, specifically. But just a, you know, beautiful metropolitan, you know, cosmopolitan, changing city, so you get a lot of influences coming in, very artistic and musical. So far, so good. I like it.
Cool. Well, listen, in 2019, I believe it was, is when you kind of launched your media company, Manny Faces Media. Is that when you started doing the podcasting as well, or were you doing it before that?
I was doing it before that. That move kind of solidified it as sort of an entrepreneurial, self-employed kind of thing. So. Mm-hmm. For a number of years, this goes back to being in New York, and this was for maybe a decade, 2008 to 2018, roundabout. I was actually doing, journalism, written word. I worked during the day for a weekly newspaper. There were still newspapers then.
Okay.
And out on Long Island, and a really good alternative news weekly. So most cities had some of them still do, and most don't, but had this sort of alternative news weekly, like the Village Voice in New York, you know, like the Boston Phoenix. And it would be this sort of just a scrappier version of the main, big corporate daily newspaper. And we would cover a bunch of stories and tell on some companies that were doing nefarious things, and maybe call out a crooked cop or just the things that sometimes would get glossed over by the major daily. And so I had always been sort of a writer and a creative writer, and I was still at the time making remixes and music stuff. I was trying to make beats and become a beat maker and a producer in the hip hop scene. But what I was also noticing was at the time, New York hip hop had sort of been relegated to the dustbin. Other cities in the country were making a lot of noise. Houston was making a lot of noise, New Orleans, and of course Atlanta. And so the New York scene was a little bit undercovered, right? The hip hop media was following the money and following the trends, and they were leaving New York behind, and there was a lot of talk of New York not being significant anymore. And I took my journalism chops that I had learned from working at this newspaper and some online work that I was doing. I was building websites and such, and I was pretty savvy. And I started a publication, an online publication called Birthplace Magazine, Birthplace, you know, for the birthplace of hip hop. Mm-hmm. And I started covering New York area. I was very journalistically centered on New York area, and much less concerned about the big superstars, and much more concerned about the independent scene. The independent artists, the local shows, mm-hmm. the showcases that had been going on for 10 years every Sunday night at the Pyramid Club in the Lower East Side. You know, these institutions of sort of independent but not superstardom hip hop that were in New York. And there were a ton of them. And I got to tell you, I was a little jaded because I'm thinking that everything is now radio rap. It's all, you know, it's all this, you know, glamour and all the negative things that people sometimes ascribe to hip hop. And I'm in New York, and these guys are incredibly artistic. There's bands, there's spoken word, there's, you know, freestyle where they're making up things at the top of their head and doing it in a competition, you know, form, and, you know, places like Freestyle Mondays or End of the Week, and it's so exciting and vibrant and brilliant. Mm-hmm. And so I started writing about it and covering it. An offshoot of that became the New York Hip Hop Report, which was a podcast, really. It was like sports talk radio. I would just get on every Sunday night, and I'd have a co-host, and we'd take calls, and we would just talk about, you know, New York area hip hop. And cool. We did that for a couple of years. And that was my first foray into like saying, okay, this podcasting thing, this idea of having an on-demand radio show is a thing. Mm-hmm. And so eventually I found that there were so many people doing, what I was discovering was people using hip hop in ways that might surprise and do surprise folks who aren't really attached to the culture or to the genre as much, in really innovative ways, not just entertainment. Again, in these entertainment ways that are very creative and very, you know, brilliant, really, but also in school settings, mm-hmm. you know, using hip hop as sort of a tool to deliver material to kids so that they can learn things better, in mental health settings, you know, using it as sort of their form of therapy. Hey, write a rap song about how you feel, you know, instead, you know, they used to ask us, you know, write a poem about how you feel, you know, and I don't know, we mm-hmm. weren't all very tuned in with poetry, but all these kids are tuned in with rap, so right. they know how to do that. And when I started realizing all this was happening and that this was nationwide, I kind of shifted my focus. And as a journalist, I said, well, I'm going to sunset the New York-centric stuff, and I really want to explore and start telling the stories of these incredible people that are doing all this really innovative work, utilizing this music and culture that's now become so ingrained in society, but using it to really in ways that benefit humanity. Yeah. And so I shifted, and that's where, you know, you'll see the more recent stuff where I was doing Hip Hop Can Save America, the podcast. That's where that came from.
Right.
And where I decided to try to institutionalize it in the nonprofit, and then I was working with the newspaper company turned into a marketing company, and I was setting up their podcasting division, and I was doing podcasts for them and some white label, you know, work for clients. And so I brought it all under. I made the leap. I said, you know, when's a great time to start a business? 6 months before a pandemic and a global shutdown. That'd be a great time. That'd be a perfect time.
Exactly.
To do this.
Exactly.
And that's what I did. But, you know, I've managed to hang on and still remain sort of self-employed doing some of this work, which is, again, in my baby, my wheelhouse, mm-hmm. and then still doing outside work for folks to help pay the bills.
Okay, cool. You know, I thought what was interesting, too, is I wanted to know how you got into public speaking from that, because that's another whole other world that people groom for and train for to get into. But the key seems to be to have a voice, or I should say a point of view. That's what really seems to get attached to effective, popular public speakers. And you have a point of view, and that's the hip-hop advocacy, no matter what you're talking about. And I think that's pretty cool. How did you get into that?
Yeah, I think that was just sort of a natural offshoot of doing this work and then either telling people about it or sort of analyzing the media landscape. Mm-hmm. And realizing that you know, hip hop media is very lazy in a way, a lot of it, most of it, in that it's just following the music and the trends and all the, you know, lucrative, you know, front facing, money making music, radio, artist, gossip, you know, all that stuff. And this is a trend that's happened not just in hip hop journalism, but as you know, music journalism, mm-hmm. all journalism, you know, and kind of lamenting that not only do people who are outside of hip hop not know that these things, these great things are happening, that sometimes even hip hop fans, older hip hop fans who are not connected to today's quote unquote today's music, mm-hmm. they're not feeling a connection to the culture that they love and grew up with and feel could be so beneficial and influential. So it started developing as to me kind of, you know, trying not to be the guy like, you know, get off my lawn or yelling into the wind, but advocating for it, saying, hey, listen, I understand where you're coming from. Look at all these things that I'm focusing on. Look at the people who are doing this work. Let me tell you their stories. Let me, you know, help do that. And I did that through journalism, through the podcast and through writing. And then the next kind of evolution of that was, you know, well, there's a, you know, an academic conference, you know, that is introducing some of these ideas, and I can write pretty well, and let me put together kind of a paper, you know, or a presentation, mm-hmm. and go present it. And then that started being well received. And then I said, you know, what I should be doing is getting into places where I'm not maybe I'm the only hip hop guy in the room, but it's an important place where these intersections are happening. So an education space. I do keynotes at tech conferences sometimes, mm-hmm. where I go through the whole history of this intersection of hip hop and technology. It's really been fascinating if you look at it to see how much hip hop has innovated music technology.
Yeah.
And how technology has helped hip hop become, you know, this global phenomenon. So there's a lot of real intersectionality there and brilliance, again, having hip hop heads who very often didn't have the resources, didn't come from communities where science and technology were very prevalent, didn't come from schools where the funding was there. We're talking about black and brown communities throughout America where they didn't have all the resources, and yet and still they found these very clever, ingenious ways to kind of buck the system and go around and come in the back door and hack mm-hmm. their way into creating this multi-billion-dollar industry. So when I tell these stories, people are fascinated. And then I say, well, this is, you should be hiring people that have, you know, hip-hop sensibilities, like, because inherently we know how to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it became an advocacy, a kind of a mission,
okay.
You know, that I'm able to tell these stories. I'm collecting all these stories and all these, you know, anecdotes, and I'm reading, like, research papers. It's ridiculous. I'm reading research papers, and, you know, and you know, saying, okay, now where can I help amplify these missions? Because if the core of what I do is, if hip hop, which a lot of people just don't get this concept, if hip hop can help people's lives in innovative, inspiring, and surprising ways, a la helping them do better in school, mm-hmm. we should be doing more of that.
Right.
You know, and we just don't see it as much as we should. And I know that there's a lot of, you know, misconceptions, negative perceptions that we have to fight through. And so I said, if I'm able to help use my skill set and get this information into the people's hands who can do something about it, then maybe in some way I'm helping mm-hmm. people improve their lives.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So that kind of became the mission.
Very, very cool. Tell me a little bit about the health and wellness aspect, or is that just kind of broad because it's better? I mean, are you working with, for example, any hospitals or agencies that are dealing with people where the music is employed in their processes?
So this comes up a lot in the mental health, as I touched on earlier. So in school counseling, for example, there's a blossoming intersection of it, across all kind of therapy. There's this idea of hip hop therapy, mm-hmm. and it takes a bunch of different forms. And I've interviewed some of the folks. This is what I have on the podcast. I interview the experts, and then I just distill their information when I can, and then point you in their direction. But it shows up in a few ways. And one of the best examples is in school counseling sessions. So there's a guy named JC Hall. He's in the Bronx. And he comes from one of these, you know, quote-unquote rough-and-tumble high schools in these rough-and-tumble neighborhoods. And he's a school counselor, and what they've done is they've built a small recording studio inside the school. It started off as a pilot program, just kind of get a bunch of kids together, and we'll meet at lunch or we'll meet after school, and we'll use music as sort of there's two ways that you can do this. Number one, you can use it for kids to kind of express themselves, as we talked about before. You know, instead of writing a poem, they're going to write a rap. They feel familiar and comfortable with putting their feelings out in this form. And sometimes it's embellishment and, you know, it's theatrical and dramatic. But sometimes it's very heartfelt and pure. And the other way is that school counselors and therapists have found a way to say, okay, I'm not 16 years old, and I'm not in touch with the music that, you know, their lifestyle, their music, their culture, everything that they're into. But I remember being 16 years old and how hip hop, you know, affected me. What can I use in their world that we could find some parallels? You know, what songs do they listen to, and that I may not like because I'm older. You know how it is. We're a generation removed. Everything sucks, right? All the music sucks.
You have to fight that, don't you?
Right. But we can look at that from a subjective, and we could talk about that all day. But the point is that our kids, our young people, are connecting to certain songs, and we may not like the content. We may not understand why they're connecting to this. But if we use that as a starting point, we can simply ask why. You know, why does this song resonate with you? Why is this song where someone's talking about what we might look at as, negative, right? Drug use, recreational drug use, depression stuff. That's sort of like a emo rap thing that's happening in these days. And we could say this is terrible, but some of the older hip hop heads will say, you know, we used to rap about being tough and selling drugs and now they rhyme about taking drugs. And I'm like, well, the first wasn't that much better, but okay.
Yeah, really.
You know, it implies that there's some sort of softness
to early classic rock and realize that's what they were saying when I was a kid. I mean, it's all the same.
100%.
Everyone's pushing the limit to get the attention and not get in trouble. And tell their story, you know. So I mean, it's
100%.
Yeah. So I totally get that.
And so we use that as a way. I was saying, not to cut you off. Let's say we use that as a way to introduce, to work with kids and show them that we'll meet them where they are. And therapists and school counselors have found incredible success at doing this. To where, you know, there's a lot of kids that might be in those neighborhoods that are facing trauma all the time or facing, you know, violence in their neighborhoods. Doesn't mean that they're violent, but they're faced with it and they're surrounded by it. And if you can get them to talk about it or interact or make songs about it, that's cathartic, and that's what all counselors and therapists seek to do, is to give, you know, especially young people, this way to get it off their chest and to, you know, to bring it to light. So hip-hop, specifically because it's the culture of the day, but also because, you know, hip-hop's really good at putting a lot of words together in four bars. You know, you can get a lot of information out. And it works, and it just simply works, and there's now more studies being done and more examples of this, because it's very hard to get a school to sign off on this, or parents even. Now, you're not going to bring rap, that crap, into the school and get my kids. No, we're not going to. But if you show that, no, this is different, we're doing something different than what you think,
right?
And that is very beneficial, we're just trying to amplify that.
You know, it's interesting. I think that music is always therapy emotionally for anyone, really, especially when it resonates with them. And I have a friend who's doing music therapy for dementia patients, and she's playing music from the 40s and 50s and to people who are sitting in homes who never move. And when she comes for their session, they're up out of their chairs until she comes back again next week. I mean, the music changes their life because there is an emotional connection. You know, and I think that when you get to wordplay, the other thing about music is it actually is good for all parts of the brain. As they remove this music classes from school, if you bring hip-hop lessons in for language, to go through the struggle of writing that rhyme in rhythm and your story is every bit as good for the brain as trying to learn music. I mean, that's part of what that's all about. Yeah. So I think it's good for you every way you do it.
I mean, I agree. I think there's practical connections, like a program.
Do you freestyle?
I have.
I'll tell you the one time I tried. I'm driving.
I have this.
Put you guys in a car to lunch. I'm working on a record, and the kid in the back is just spitting these lines, talking about street signs he's seen and people that are walking by in cars. And I'm like, dude, you're talking about like what you see right now in real time. He's doing this, right? It's all rhyming, and his vibe is killing. Yeah. So I'm like, let me try that. I got about two words out, and I got stuck. You know, and I thought, holy cow. Number one, it's a talent. And number two, it's an awareness and such a quick spin of everything you're seeing, and you're looking ahead in terms of phrasing and rhyming and rhythm, just with taking random things that are happening in front of you. Is that's amazing mind to capture that and spit that out like that.
I say this with absolute sincerity, and you know, I'm a smart guy. I know some smart people. Some of the most brilliant folks I know on the planet are freestyle battle rappers. That they do that, they have that ability. They can do it on stage.
Yeah.
There's a great, I mentioned Freestyle Mondays. They had this great game show competition where they would spin a wheel and it'd be a random category and it'd be like, you know, food chain. And then one competitor has to be either a shark and the other has to be algae and they'd battle go.
Oh my gosh.
Like, you have to be so, and they would do it. They would kill it. It was
dude,
amazing.
I would stand there. I would stand there going, I don't know where to start. You know, I just think that's
and they
freaking
would
amazing.
Like 30 seconds.
Yeah. And it was amazing. So that's,
not only that, there's some, I was going to say, there's actually, they had done some scientific stuff where they, you know, check out like the parts of your brain that are lighting up, you know, when you're doing, and freestyle rap, I think it was pretty consistent with like jazz music, like the improvisational activity that a jazz musician might have.
That makes
sense.
Really,
it's a really brilliant form of communication. And I'll tell you this, anyone, you know, we're all, as kids growing up in the hip hop age, we all want to be rappers at some point. I did. I made some songs.
Right.
I had a, you know, a little crew. But what I tell people all the time is that let the kids try to rap and be famous, because inevitably when they're not, which, you know, obviously it doesn't, you know, it happens, you've already planted the seeds to be a better public speaker.
Yeah.
A better communicator,
yeah.
A better on-the-spot thinker, and that helps you in meetings at work,
yeah.
And dealing with, you know, the people that you deal with in your everyday life. So there are transferable life skills that come from being a, you know, a hip-hop kid.
You know what? Just imagining and thinking and inventing in your own mind is a whole different experience than watching YouTube or watching TV and just receiving something. When you're creating something, that's and you're struggling with it, and you're finding it and making it, that's, I don't care whether what you're building, whether it's a song or a boat, you know, you're the one doing it. You know, you're thinking it, you're building it, you're creating it. That's a whole other mindset. And I always try to get the kids in my life to don't just sit around doing nothing, do something. And like, what do you mean? It's like, I don't care. Let's invent a game. What do you mean? Here's a piece of paper. Let's draw what might be the board. Well, how will it be? I don't know. See, we haven't drawn it yet. Yeah. That's why we're here. And you get them to think. You know, I think that's what writing, especially like writing hip hop, where there's so much to write, in a sense, is a great thing to be doing for your mind.
Yeah, yeah. And you see that all across hip hop, from, you know, from graffiti, you know, which again has this negative connotation, but the intricacies of the artwork and trying to be different than somebody else and try to have a style that can be recognized, dance moves, you know, breaking and trying to, you know, one up the next person with something that's never been seen before, or taking an old, I was telling the other day that, you know, the Kid and Play, you know, used to have dance, and they had a dance step called the Kid and Play Kick Step. And it was these, you know, this foot motion where they'd kind of go in and syncopate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was a kid, I was in the kitchen and I'm trying to do the Kid and Play Kick Step, because it's right around when House Party came out, and I'm in the kitchen and I'm failing because I'm not terribly good at dancing, and I'm trying to, you know, move my legs and kick my feet up and go back and forth, and my mother walks in and she goes, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Leave me alone, Mom. You don't know what I'm doing. I'm doing it. It's a Kid and Play Kick Step. I'm trying to get this dance move down." And she watches me for about 5 seconds and she goes, "You mean this?" And bow, she and she does it. And I'm like, "What are you?" She goes, "That's the Charleston," and then walks out the room.
Oh my god, you're kidding me. That's funny.
The ultimate mic drop, but that's it. Like, the Kid and Play Kick Step was a modern variation of the Charleston.
Right.
So again, using, you know, the past and flipping it and remixing it in a creative way is an exercise of ingenuity all the time.
That's
hip-hop
crazy.
All the time.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
Listen, are you still DJing, or are you mostly just running the nonprofit and public speaking?
Yeah, not. I mean, I wasn't a big, you know, play out kind of guy. I was when I was in New York, and I was, you know, a little bit more connected to a lot of folks that I'd known for a long time. I am a band. I'm a DJ for a band. It's called the band called Fuse. Just want to shout them out.
Cool.
They're based out of New Jersey for the most part, and so I'm the band DJ, and we were doing monthly showcases, and they tour sometimes, and I've toured with them. So they'll do a quarterly showcase now out in Brooklyn. So I flew back and was able to, you know, rock with them back in February, and I'll probably be back in May. And then occasionally, I do brunches, and I'll do kind of some special events. And sometimes, even when I go to these academic conferences, I was at Harvard. there's a wonderful hip hop education. Yeah, and so I was at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, where they're teaching teachers, you know, some of these things we're talking about today.
Cool.
And I moderated a panel, I did a talk, and then while I was there, I DJed the after party for all the, you know, for
that's
all the
kids. Cool.
So it was a good time.
That is cool.
So I do it when I can.
That's nice. Hey, you know, the gear, just to talk about equipment relating to DJing, that's changed dramatically. Yeah. I mean, these days with these little digital... I cannot scratch on a digital pad, but now they've got, you know, so many ways to crossfade digital files, and with AI pulling things out of songs and just using those, it's nuts to watch a good DJ with a digital system now. It's a whole other game.
Oh yeah, I mean the Serato stems, being able to, you know, instantly, you know, kind of pull out the vocals and kind of make these mixes on, again, on the fly. These you know, allows DJs now to improvise on the fly, which I've always done that, where I've taken, you know, you got to go find the instrumental and you got to find the acapella right. And you know,
and carry 17 crates of records to the gig, you know.
Well, that too, but that's the thing. And again, that technology goes all the way back to, you know, Grandmaster Flash, if you watch you know, videos of him, where, you know, he invented the continuing of the break on two turntables. So, you know, take the little one section of the record where the drum drops, and it's just the drums, and you'd have double records, and you go back and forth. They didn't have a crossfader. He had to invent that. He had to find the right. He tells a great story about having to find the right record player. He called it the torque theory, that there would be enough torque when you threw the record forward that it wouldn't start up like this, and that, you know, that it had to go start up really fast and have the right amount of torque. This is like an 18-year-old kid that didn't have an engineering background, and he's trying to figure out the best turntable with the best torque, and which of the needles, whether it's a conical needle, you know, or not, would stay in the groove of the record. Would he go back and forth, but had a lesser of a stereo spectrum? He tells all these stories about figuring this out as a kid. That's and amazing. I'm like, he was an engineer.
It's amazing.
He was a self-taught engineer that invented things that now, as you say, are part of any kind of electronic music, whether it's DJing, EDM, anything. It was all from these hip-hop kids in the Bronx, you know, surrounded by rubble and burnt-down buildings and no arts education and no, you know, anything, and finding these amazing ways to come together, bring people together, and it continues to this day.
I worked on a couple records with DMX when he came out to Arizona to work. And he told me some stories about when he was coming up, what he would do. And he said that he had one of those little boombox cassette decks, you know. And he said he'd pop a blank cassette in, and he'd stand at the street corner where a street light was. And when the light would go, you know, yellow to red, and the car slowing down, he'd start walking up to the car and start rapping about them and their car and this corner and what they're wearing. And then when he would see the other light turn or it's about to go, he'd stop it, pop the tape out, and stick it in their face, going, $5, come on, $5, $5.
And customized.
Hey man, and he's like, talk about again ingenuity. Like, you know what? I'm not gonna go sit on the corner like everybody and wait my turn to turn this into my block. And I'm gonna go do my thing. And I'm going to show people this is good. So I thought that was just a fascinating story, taking it back to how it all started. And the neat thing was with hip hop, I think in the beginning, you know, before hip hop, you had to buy an instrument and get taught how to play it to get into any band or any kind of music. And all of a sudden, when you had a beat box, whether it was a drum machine or a boom box that would play a tape that had a beat on it, and you could plug a microphone into that thing, It changed the world for creators that didn't have access to musical instruments. And I think that the music world wasn't prepared, the upper echelon of the industry wasn't prepared for that to be music, because, you weren't playing anything. You weren't playing a musical instrument. How could this be music? And it's like, is my voice not a musical instrument? Yes. Okay.
Right.
Then we're done.
There's
we're done
no
with this
melody. I'm like, I mean, there is, though.
There is
melody in the vocals.
Yeah, and there's not only that, there's melody in the production of the sounds you use to put together. The fact that you have five pieces to your beat, each of those have sounds. Boop, bop, bop, boom, bop, bop. I mean, it has a melody. Even the groove is going to have a melody with the instruments you use. But
It's funny, you know, I have these arguments, of course, with my dad because he was a jazz and blues purist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, and I wish I knew now because now I would blow him out of the water. He was a college professor. His debate skills were impeccable. It's why I cut my teeth on the advocating for this stuff. But, you know, it's funny. They talk about it's not traditional music. Well, the drum is the most traditional of music.
There you go.
In humankind.
That's,
you know,
right.
The drums, taking it back to early civilization. The drums and the voice, and that's all we had.
That's right.
And so it's the most tied to our DNA, I think, of all music. So there's something to be said there.
And, you know, and every new music, to call it that, is called not music by the people before it. Jazz was not music. Rock was not music.
Right.
You know, that's not music, and it's like, it's the devil's music, whatever you want to call it. It's just it's not accepted because it's not what we're doing, you know. So that's part of growing old and putting up with that, I suppose. You know, one interesting thing I've found, I have an 18 and a half year old daughter. She's, you know, in the beginning, like 12, 13, 14, it was all hip hop. She always blasts her music when she's in the shower, right? Blasts and then hops in the shower. I'm hearing Billy Joel come blaring out of the bathroom, and I'm thinking, what in the world is going on? And so I'm kind of paying a little attention, and I realize that I think that's one of the good things about shuffle playing, the concept of Spotify's playlists. These kids today are not only introduced to radio, but they're being introduced to all kinds of things that they never, that a generation ago could never have found because it wasn't on the radio. And it's really opening up their interests, and that's going to impact what everybody's creating. I think you see a lot of new music, actually, that's more interesting than 10 years ago, even.
Yeah, I think so, too. And again, now the hip-hop purists are having the same conversations. Like, that's not, you know, that's not hip-hop.
Yeah,
that's not rap,
because
it's very genre.
Yeah.
Right, but it's very, because their last stuff now is very genre-bending.
Mm-hmm.
But I always say, like, that's if you like hip-hop, you obviously already like an amalgamation of different genres, because there's, you know, there's traditional R&B, there's stuff that we sample. We've always sampled Billy Joel. I sampled Billy Joel and made remixes of dope beats from Billy Joel. You know, so we've done that for almost, you know, from the sampling era, you know, on in hip hop. So if you come up and you're sort of a musical hip hop native, or, you know, today, you know, an 18-year-old would be perfectly. They're already used to accepting different vibes, different sounds, different, you know, genres. Then you get TikTok, and they're introduced to, you know, these snippets of song. My daughter was 7, and she's walking around the house. It's tricky to rock around, that's right on time, it's tricky. And I'm like, that's Run DMC. Why do you know Run DMC? What's going on?
Isn't that funny?
And, you know, it's crazy, but TikTok does that. And so now you have this really interesting time, as you point out, to your point, where you have new influences that are all over the place. Old influences now coming back, you know, into you know, into fashion. You know, old, what's old is new again. And what could all of that combine?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at a very interesting. I think we're in an interesting spot for what's going to be coming around the corner. And I think the same thing applies to film, because every kid's now has gotten, you know, 10, 15 years of movie making before he ever decides to be a filmmaker with their cameras.
Right.
You know, so, and everybody has to do video content constantly, whether they're a musician or a business. So the next generation of filmmakers too. I mean, where things are going, I think artistically, it's fascinating to speculate what's going to be coming down the pike. You know.
Yep, I was talking to a bunch of, I did a, you know, a career day at a school, and so a bunch of third graders mostly, and I made that point, and I said, you know, what you're doing with your selfies and shopping your videos together, because I was talking about journalism and saying that that's a career path you can go. I said, but you don't have to be a writer,
right?
You could be a photojournalist, you could be a videographer, and you could actually be, you know, kind of putting these incredible stories together, these documentary, you know, films. That's all journalism. And y'all already know how to do some of that. Like,
I know.
Some of the editing these folks are doing, and I'm like, man, I don't have time to figure this out. This is amazing. And they, you know, so you're right. They're right out of the gate. They're learning these skills that, you know, obviously we're in a time where it's so easy to spread misinformation, and it's so, you know, easy to, you know, not know what's truthful, or not, you know, what's made by a person, what's made by AI.
Right.
So we always have these sort of it can go either way moments,
right?
But having young people having these skills sort of natively from an early stage, I think is the pros are going to outweigh the cons.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I'm glad you are, because I think you're right. It's one of those times. You look at deep fakes and you look at AI and you go, oh, this could be bad. So, you know, I hope we kind of turn that corner before it is. But listen, you know, we've been at this for about 45 minutes already. I can't believe it. And oh, I don't want to let you go without talking about your kidney doning situation. I don't know anything about this, but what happened? Is this a family?
Oh, thanks.
Family
So my daughter was 27 at the time. And we hadn't grown up together, but we had, you know, had a relationship. And what had happened, she'd had basically a blood disorder that when it's sort of untreated can affect your kidneys in a really negative way. And by the time it was noticed, it was a little bit late, and she had to, you know, go in for, you know, treatment and was on dialysis at 27. It was pretty serious business. So I went through the process of, you know, being tested and becoming a match. And yeah, I'm a blood relative, obviously, so there's, you know, usually a better chance of that. And after about a year of going through it, we had to change insurances. It was a big whole thing. But you know, they sit you down and make sure you know all the ramifications of what you're doing. And it's actually, for a donor, and I really advocate for this, it's really not a big deal. I mean, it's a major surgery, and it's, you know, I got a beautiful C-section scar. But it's, you can live with one kidney. Many people do. Some people are born with one kidney and they don't even know it. They have no way of knowing it until you get surgery. And they're like, hey, by the way, you only have one kidney. And so kidney donation is a very common, as far as these things go, very successful rate. Most people survive it just well. I donated to her. We went through the surgery. We'll be 4 years this April.
Awesome.
No lingering effects at all for me. As a recipient, she has to take medicines and kind of go back and get checked out a lot. And she may need one again in, you know, 10, 12, 15 years. They say sometimes even a live donor doesn't last forever. But she's absolutely healthy and glowing, beautiful young lady doing great things. And so far, so good.
Man, that's fantastic. And congratulations to both of you. I think that's awesome. Just awesome.
Thank you.
Wow.
It was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I talk about it very matter-of-factly, but it's very surreal.
It is
surreal.
Very incredible. And the neat thing is, I think, you know, people talk about our kids, you know, they live on, but it's like, hey, yeah, you live on in your child, you know, in that way, you know.
Yeah.
And to be able to help and provide that in that way is just fantastic. It's awesome.
Yeah.
So what do you got coming up? What's happening next?
Yeah, I'm still, you know, so we're expanding Hip Hop Save America podcast. I've started doing it on YouTube as well, so we have a visual component now, which is nice. And that's just starting out, but doing pretty well so far. I also work on a couple of other important podcasts, one of which is called Newsbeat, which is sort of a more journalistically focused. We take social justice issues and some of those stories that you hear about, and we kind of go in deeper on some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting because we interview people who are either experts or activists or people who are facing some form of injustice. We interview them. We weave the whole thing under a bed of music, so it's very documentary sounding, like scored a little bit. And then for many episodes, we invite a independent hip hop artist to drop 3 16-bar verses intermittently through the episode.
Ah, cool.
Kind of as Act One, Act Two, Act Three. So it amplifies a kind of exclamation points, you know, some of the points being made in the episode. We like to say it's like Democracy Now! And Hamilton had a podcast baby. So I'm working on that. That's, you know, ongoing. And yes, more speaking engagements. I'll be out in California in April and got some other things brewing, and I'm working on some writing and putting a book together and a bunch of things like that. But it's mainly just out there telling these stories, amplifying the voices of these people who are doing really great work, helping out a lot of people in ways that, you know, we just don't hear about too often.
Yeah.
However I can do that, I'm going to keep doing it.
That's very cool, Manny. So for people to get a hold of you or track you down, Googling the Center for Hip Hop Advocacy might help. Obviously, your name. I think your website is your name, right? MannyFaces.com.
Yep. MannyFaces.com. And then I have, you know, kind of clicks to all the offshoots of all the various things I do. I do have the newsletter, which is the Substack at mannyfaces.substack.com, and I send out information. Like the stuff we've been talking about, I send it out in a newsletter so people can
That's
sit
cool.
with it and digest it at their own time.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully if anybody wants to get a hold of you, they can. So that way, that's cool. If they're not listening live, this will be posted tomorrow morning. It'll be up 24/7. I'll send you a link. You can share it with whoever you like. And I guess, is there anything else you wanted to touch on?
No, I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate kicking it with you. And I will think of you every time I play Finally.
Oh, man, please do. that song is in my heart. I think of me, and I think of her every time that song plays. So it's a wonderful record and a big part of my life. So that's cool. Thanks.
Very cool.
All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on, man. You have a great night.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
You got it. Take care. Let's talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
And you've been listening to me and my guest, Manny Faces, here on the Auto D Show tonight. And thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week.